coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK, the internet radio of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of England. I'm your host, Jamie Krieger. I am pastor of Resurrection Lutheran Church in Cambridge. At Resurrection, we have adult Bible study at 10 a.m. every Sunday while the children are in Sunday school. At 11 a.m., we gather for the Divine Service with Holy Communion. For more information about our congregation, go to resurrectionlutheran.org.uk. I'm also pastor of the Oxford Lutheran Mission. Pastor Tapani Simeoki and myself take turns to meet with the congregation there at 4:30 in the afternoon at St. Michael's and All Angels every second and fourth Sunday of the month. For more information about this, go to oxfordlutheran.co.uk. If you are nowhere near these congregations, go to lutheran.co.uk. This is the website of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of England, and it has information about all our congregations in England, Wales, and Scotland. I am also manager of Lutheran Radio UK. I hope you enjoy listening to our programs as much as we enjoy producing them for you. Find our entire schedule and the podcasts of all our programs at lutheranradio.co.uk. We are in Holy Week, and today we will look at the lessons for Easter Sunday. The readings are from Isaiah 25, verses 6 to 9, the Psalm is 16. The epistle lesson is from Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, the 15th chapter, verses 1 through to 11. And the gospel lesson is from the Gospel according to St. Mark, the 16th chapter, the first 8 verses. David, happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you. Mark's take on the resurrection, there is so much here, obviously, and so it's a bit arbitrary what a preacher will focus on. But for our purposes today, the angel's first command after the resurrection was to these first witnesses. Now, we have to remind ourselves that these were the first witnesses of what we take to be the greatest material death-defying act in all of history. No one has ever done anything physically remotely as great as defeating death. Now, obviously, a lot of people are cynical and skeptical about this claim, and so they wouldn't see it this way, but we as Christians believe that the resurrection is like no other event in all of history. Well, actually, it's a lot like the creation. It's the second creation. But whatever it is, it's a material act. It happened in the body. There were great stones there. There was physical smells. And it was a physical act that not only was death-defying, it was hope-defining. It changed everything. Now, that's just a long preface, because the angel said to these first witnesses, calm down. Don't be alarmed. Don't get excited about this. And this seems to be the very opposite of what one would expect after seeing the effects of the resurrection. The angel was making it clear they were not witnessing a circus. They were seeing the beginning of the second creation. They were alarmed because they and we have grown accustomed to the triumphant death terminating all of life. Now they would need to calm down in order to become reaccustomed to the new edifying role that death would now play in our pilgrimage on the path of life. So the first Easter was not a point of which people were to get all excited. They were to do the opposite. They were to calm down. And the angel's command, do not be excited, anticipates Jesus' often post-resurrection greeting, peace be with you. In other words, the resurrection, this very physical act, introduces a new spiritual reality that is radically different and will radically change the world that we live in. It will no longer be dominated by the fear and anxiety and despair caused by death. It will rather be a world that is on the path towards peace. And so that being the case, the angel's first command makes sense. I want to also point out that the angel gets a little dig in at the end, noting that Jesus's death-defying greatest physical act in all of history would not have surprised any of them had they been paying attention to Jesus's teachings. Now these first witnesses of the new reality that has been inaugurated by Jesus's resurrection would need Jesus's teachings to help them and us in the lifelong task of becoming accustomed to living calmly, being free of death's tyranny. So the resurrection, even though we like to celebrate it with, you know, special instruments and special music, that shouldn't change. But the point of the resurrection is expressed by that angel in calming down and coming to grips with life that is no longer tyrannized by death. Psalm 16 elaborates beautifully on this idea where the psalmist says, make me know the path of life. So in other words, the resurrection has already blazed a new path of life. What remains, and this is why we pray, is that God would repeatedly make known this truth to us. Because it's so easy to forget that we are on the path of life and begin to fear that we are really, in fact, on the path to death. But the path does not lead to death, it leads through death. And it still seems to us when we are faced with that, that life stops at death. But that is a lie. The resurrection has made has changed that lie, and no longer can death be continually leading us to despair. The psalm outlines the alternative, which is a peace that is experienced when we are on the resurrection's path of life. It is possible now to calm down because we have a master who has already passed through death and who knows our good, says the psalm. Obedience is the word used. It's not a word that means that we are now enslaved. The word literally means to hyper hear, to hear with more attention. It means giving rapt attention to the word of life. One of the benefits of this way of life, says that the psalm, is holiness. Now, we oftentimes think of holiness as something which is a refusal of life. Not in the scriptures. Holiness is a kind of might or power or vigor of those whose holy desire for life evermore will be fulfilled. Holiness is a kind of hyper hope that all of the things which are only partially true here, all of our emptinesses, all of our inadequacies, all of our disgraces are going to be changed and filled and made whole. So when we experience the back from the dead wholeness of the resurrection, all other claims of life are found wanting and weak and just not very inviting. What once holiness is our hope, which is the hope of the resurrection, then every other hope just seems rather thin and pale. Now, the way the psalm expresses this is that this is not a hope that waits for after death. This is not a hope that somehow doesn't change the physical world. This spiritual hope changes everything in our physical life. The resurrection is a physical act that changes everything in the world. And it imparts this by the various organs that are used in the Jewish literature that express this inner spiritual life. So the kidneys, this psalm actually for conscience, it uses the same word as kidneys. Later it will use the word liver, which the translation I use translates it heart, and that is where hope resides. So Jesus' resurrection was a rejection of death and the restoration of the body. The people who like killing are the ones who hate the body. The resurrection is the place in which God celebrates the body because it is no longer determined by death. And so now that life is present in our mortal bodies, we continue on a path towards eternity. And so the psalm declares that even in this life, even though we are passing through death, the psalm ends with saying, joys overflow in your presence, delights in your right hand forever. Now, Isaiah gives us a different way to look at the post-resurrection reality. Looking at God in whom we hope. The resurrection redefines the meaning of hope. People use the word hope now without belief in the resurrection, but that is a very, very, that's just a shadow of what true hope is. When we live under the shadow of death, the best we could hope for is a life that is akin to a lean morsel of bread and a bit of water. After the resurrection, when the path of life leads to eternity, Isaiah says, it is as if the Lord prepared a banquet for all peoples on this mountain, a banquet of rich food, a banquet of well-aged wines, rich food with marrow, well-aged wines, fine strain. Amazing. The little bit of that passes for hope in this life is nothing compared to the way the resurrection defines hope. And I like the fact that eating is the metaphor that Isaiah uses in order to talk about the new resurrection. And he extends that metaphor by saying that when God has done his work, death is swallowed up forever, and sorrowful tears are wiped away from every face, and God's grace is exchanged for our disgrace. So the idea of this life being no more than a very small, meager meal compared to the remarkable hope that we have when we come to eternity. And we get a small taste of that in the sacrament, that the sacrament is not the feast. The sacrament is a foretaste of this life. And the life to come compares to that little bite of bread and the little sip of wine in comparison to this feast that Isaiah lays out. And so Isaiah ends triumphantly. This is our own God in whom we've hoped. Let us exult and rejoice in his rescue, which is what we do on Easter. And finally, Paul takes post-resurrection reality in a very different way when he says that God's grace toward me was not in vain. Now, what Paul wants to drive home is the point that the resurrection was a very physical act, and so he goes through a whole litany of those who physically witnessed history's greatest material act in the resurrection. That very material act seen by many physical eyes inaugurated a new life-giving, reality-changing, and hope-redefining immaterial dynamism. But it was a physical act. This big change, Paul sums up in one word. He calls it grace. That is the meaning of grace. It is enjoying the effect, the new reality of Jesus's death and resurrection. Now, what impressed Paul about history's greatest death-defying material act is this grace's intention or aim, an unimpressive aim to change all of reality, to conform all of reality to the resurrection by calmly working in each individual's heart or liver or kidney. And Paul seems to very much enjoy that the way that God works, that God wanted to put that fully on display in Paul's life, making Paul the most unlikely convert. There seems to be a real joy about the modest way that God's worked and the surprising ways of the resurrection. And it seems that Paul enjoys the irony of the resurrection. This is grace, he calls it, which means it is fully God's work. But then notice what Paul says. God's work energized Paul in a way that he worked harder than any of the other disciples. And that because all of this is grace, comparing one's work to another person is just plain ridiculous. That's what Paul's point is. In other words, being caught up in this post-resurrection grace is a kind of calmness about life. And it's a calmness which is not unexciting. It's a calmness which comes to expect the unexpected twists like Paul's own conversion. And that leads to Paul's happy boast in the end that the grace of God is with me. And that seems like a small thing to say, but for Paul, that is the truth that changes all of reality. So there is much to say on Easter morning, and I would kind of suggest that it not be said. There is so much great music, and there's so many other things going on. I've never actually been successful in trying it, but to me, a short but explosive celebration of this inauguration of new reality would be a fitting conclusion, sticking the dismount of what began on Ash Wednesday with Lent and the Easter season.
Thank you once again, David. This is as much as we can do today. I pray this has been very useful to our listeners. Just reminding our listeners that the podcasts of this program, Worth Doing Badly, are available online on our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app for mobile phones. Go to the App Store or Google Play and download the one that is right for you to listen to us on the go. David, once again, thank you very much. We'll talk again next week.
Thank you.